Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to The Wild Hunt, the No Ship Network podcast on the history television series Vikings. I'm your host, Steve.
And I'm your host, Em.
And tonight, we are drinking ale from Curved Horns.
Not really.
Actually, we're not. We're drinking tea from coffee cups.
Yes.
But that's close. I mean, that's close.
I would like to have some ale, but I am under the weather, as people say. So, we are discussing Vikings Season 5, Episode 18, and this one's titled Balder. This was written by Michael Hurst and directed by Helen Shaver. All right, and we are going to start off as we have been pretty much all season with the location of Iceland. I think a lot of us thought we were done with Iceland last episode, but I knew we weren't.
I think a lot of us were hoping we were done with Iceland yeah. last episode, but we weren't. But we're, you know, I don't feel like we're going to be done with it until we see Floki sailing away.
I don't think he's going to sail away from Iceland.
Okay. Well, then we're not going to be done with it then, because I think we're going to have, in one way, shape, or form, we're going to have Floki around for a little while longer. So if he's to stay on Iceland, then we're going to be stuck with Iceland.
I don't know. We might see the last of Floki next episode.
Possibly. That's kind of risky, but I mean, I don't know. I don't know. It's a tough one for me to believe, because I always think of, it's cynical of me, but I always think in terms of viewer retention. And I feel like getting Ragnar out of the picture was a pretty big thing. And I think they lost a lot of viewers because of that, unfortunately. I don't really have any stats to back that up, but it's just a gut feeling that I have.
Okay, well, I believe he is really, truly done with humans.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think he's going to be around other humans again. So I don't know how far they can carry that storyline into another season.
True. Yeah, I guess we'll see. It doesn't bode well that he's going to walk into the mouth of hell. I mean, nothing good can really be there. He didn't even have a torch. So,
but that's what he came to Iceland for, right? He believed it was the land of the gods, and he, even after getting to know Eyjord and thinking he had followers who were joined in faith with him, it turns out that he was the only one who was a true believer. So he's now set upon the path that he originally intended on. It was like he was distracted by followers or leading others.
Yeah, all the people around him were just acting like human beings and having their petty squabbles and everything. And so you're right, it did take his focus. He took his eyes off the prize.
Well, I think there's something to it, because we have Floki and Lagertha kind of at the end of their lives and talking about themselves in ways that is similar. You have Floki talking about leaving humans, and you have Lagertha talking about how she's now without her shield. It's however that saying goes, when you die alone. And yeah. I think there's something to that.
Everybody dies alone.
Right.
Yeah. Ah, that's a sad way to look at it, though. But it does feel like that.
Yeah, but it's still a journey in and of itself, which seems like that's what Lagertha is holding on to, or that's where she's getting part of her strength from anyway,
yeah.
is the idea of there are still things to discover on the other side of the shield wall, as she says.
It's a positive way to look at that.
Yeah.
To that situation. Mm-hmm.
But we're going off track here.
Yeah.
So we see immediately that Kjetil has yet to crash from his rage high that started last episode. And this is evident by his lack of grief in response to Eyjord's death. He pretty much disowns her at this point by saying that she was more Floki's daughter by the end anyway. And Floki's close to anger at this point himself, and he begins to describe how old Floki would deal with this situation.
It's worth repeating, actually verbatim, because it's pretty like bad.
Yeah.
He says, "The man I once was would have dug this spade just deep enough into your skull to make you unconscious. Then when you woke up, I would let you witness me burning your wife alive. Then I would force your one remaining son to cut off your balls and make you eat them. As you slowly bled out, the last thing you would see would be me raping your son, not knowing if I would show him the mercy of killing him or not." Wow. Wow, wow, wow. That's just like, holy shit. And then he almost does his trademark Floki giggle. You could see it kind of bubbling up to the surface, and he swallows it down for all intents and purposes,
right.
and doesn't give it to us. But it was a really well acted scene, because he just, as they say, broke bad on this guy. And that crazy kill you Floki was just under the surface, but he said, no, the way I want to be is how I'm going to be. I'm in control, and I'm not, you know, I can't, what I've learned here is that I can't control you people. I can't make you like each other. I can't make other people change for the better, but I've changed for the better. I'm not going to let you fuck that up. So here's your shovel. Have fun. You know, and it's symbolic in that sense because it's like, try to dig your, you could do what you want, dig yourself out of this shit with the shovel.
Well, I just have a thought here that's just occurring to me because you and I have already talked about Fitzhugh off podcast about how we think his storyline up in Norway with Olaf the Stout was pretty much a test.
Yeah.
And I kind of think something similar is happening here with Floki as far as these followers that he has brought to Iceland, because he has pretty much lived like this fanatic throughout the whole series of Vikings, where he's been insisting on people see things the way or believe in the gods the way he does. And so it seems to make sense that he would have to like have this almost experiment where he can actually enact what he had always been trying to do, try to create this like utopic religious society and have it fail, and how he decides to stay on the path anyway.
That makes a lot of sense. Because if you're saying like here is this petri dish of humanity where he was able to have to, or at least he thought to be able to control all of the other factors, that would be just taken out because everybody who came here was on the same page.
Right.
So why wouldn't it work? And then it still doesn't. The shittiness of human nature still takes over, but Floki still passes the test. He doesn't revert back to the old Floki and do all of this horrible stuff. He described the kettle, and he still stays on path
right
with the gods. So yeah, I like that idea.
And I think ultimately the gods that he's going to find are going to be within himself.
So you think we're not going to see like a supernatural things? Floki's not going to actually see the gods, and we're not going to see Thor or Odin or Frey or anything like that.
We haven't yet. I mean, right. I don't think Michael Hirst has ever really been definitive about that.
I feel like it would be out of character for the show to do that, honestly. So I hope that you're right. I hope that if whatever he does see, we can attribute that to being like a manifestation coming from, you know, within himself.
Mm-hmm. Now, with everything he said to Kjetil, I exclaimed out loud when we were sitting there watching it with my dad that I don't think I've ever met that Floki. I don't recall Floki ever being that extreme.
I think it's a bit of an exaggeration that he allows himself. Like, it's a caricature of his former self just to kind of drive home the point that, like, hey, I've been super cool to you guys, and I've been this new Floki, and I've kept everything under wraps, but this old Floki, you keep pushing. It's under the surface, so I'm not going to let it get out, not because I give a shit about you, but because I don't want to do it. It's a self-control issue. But I get what you're saying 100%, and I feel like he gave himself a little artistic license with it, because we've definitely never seen that Floki. I mean, we've seen him kill some people, for sure. I mean, he just pretty much straight up killed Athelstan without any real provocation or anything, so.
But, you know, this time around when we were watching it, I was thinking about the awesomeness of that kind of power, where you have the capability to be that cruel, to dominate because of your actual physical prowess and skills as a battle-hardened warrior, all that, and still be able to decide not to do it.
Yeah.
It's not only power over others, it's power over yourself, and that's a really awesome power. I hate that the fact that I keep using the word awesome, but
it fits in this instance, though.
It, like, it does. It does,
just, you're
actually
in awe of it, because you really have to. I would argue that it is actually more of the two things: power over someone or power over yourself. In this instance, it's probably more power over yourself, because I don't think anybody doubt. I mean, Kettle's a big guy, but I don't think anybody doubted Floki could take almost anybody one on one. But I feel like the mastery of his impulsive desires and emotions is awesome.
I don't get Kjetil, though. I thought he would recover from what he was experiencing, but his indifference toward his daughter's death was shocking to me.
I agree. I feel like they took this character who had been one way the whole time and then kicked him into this other gear, and it seems right that he should have come back to that first gear that he was in and been remorseful and sorrowful and like, oh my God, what have I done? And this is so crazy. And that the death of his daughter should have driven that home, because she basically killed herself because of his actions, him and his brother and the nameless others.
Maybe that's still to come.
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah. Day late, dollar short kind of stuff. But we'll see.
Okay, so we're going to head over to York now. And immediately we are in the midst of Bjorn and Gunnhild's wedding ceremony. Harald darkly fantasizes about Gunnhild as he watches from his throne. Bjorn and Harald mutually agree to use each other and make a tentative pact. Bjorn tells Harald he will never be the king of Norway.
When Harald was watching them get married and he had his own little vision of things going on, I was just like, man, he needs some peanut butter with that jelly. He was just letting it go. I mean, he's just having this vivid waking dream style fantasy.
Yeah. And it was so well done, because I like how you see Bjorn and Gunhild go in for the kiss, and then you have the close up of Harald. And it's almost like he's trying to inhabit Bjorn at that moment. His mouth starts to work, like he is involved in that kiss. And then you see him having sex with Gunhild in this celebratory way, and he's got blood on his face, like he just destroyed Bjorn, and it is now in the throes of lovemaking with her, and she's celebrating over it.
I didn't even think of it like that.
Yeah.
Like he almost like physically inhabited his body and then came out of it.
Oh yeah,
like
burst out of his body.
burst out of Bjorn. And then, you know, he's in the moment doing that. And how about that burn when he snaps out of it and he's telling her congratulations, and she's just like, he's like, I thought you wanted to be Queen of Norway. And she's like, yeah, but I never said who I wanted to be king.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And then right out, it's like a 1-2 punch, because
it
then
is.
Right after that, he has to put up with Magnus for the requisite 10
Blurg.
Seconds. Yeah, that we have to have him in every episode, because we're just going to forget that he exists otherwise if they don't keep shoving him in our face. And so he comes to Bjorn, and Bjorn has done like just this. He was weirdly manipulative in the last episode when he was trying to get Harald to go like sail the ships back over to Kattegat in the wintertime,
right,
and everything. But this is even a step further in that direction. He's just so bold in his it's almost like he feels like he has the upper hand now, and Harald needs to kind of kowtow to him and what he wants because of his Ragnarsson-ishness,
mm-hmm,
and so on and so forth. And that's another thing. I just want to mention it now, but Ragnar is all over this episode, not just in the actual flashback that you see of him, but the way that everybody mentions him, or somebody being his son, or in this scene, you know, it's not just Bjorn being Ragnar's son. And what did you make of this whole thing about how he's pushing this on Harald, and he's kind of throwing it in his face, and he says, you're never going to be liked like Ragnar. You're never going to be respected like him. You're never going to be him, even though you wanted to. You're not going to be king of Norway, and it's not because you didn't try. It's not because you're not mighty enough or whatever have you. It's because this type of thing is a gift from the gods.
I thought a couple of things. Like, one thing I thought of is I would like to discuss, why is this true? You know, as far as like as we've seen so far, I mean, Harald has had quite a bit of success, mm-hmm, but Ragnar definitely was a more charismatic leader.
Right. I don't really know how to answer that, because if we're going off of the history, I feel like we're going to get the actual history. I feel like we're going to get a lot more mileage out of what Harald could actually do. But, you know, Hurst has already proven time and time again that he's not going to be confined by those stats, so to speak. So, I don't know. This would be a tough pill to swallow for somebody like Harald, who kind of views himself as a self-made man. Like he's very driven towards his goals. There's hard work, sacrifice. There's, you know, he has to toil and struggle to get where he's gotten. You know, I mean, sure, a lot of people do stuff for him because he's a king. I get that. But to get to the position where he was at, like, it didn't just happen overnight.
Yeah, shit does not come easy for him at all. So, I mean, comparison to someone like Ragnar.
Right, where the pieces just sort of fell into place.
I mean, Ragnar had to fight for it himself, mm-hmm, but it seems that Harald just has a little bit more of an uphill battle, and I felt bad for him, actually, and I don't know if it has more to do with performance or what, but I'm very drawn to Harald's character, and I would like to see more about Harald going forward. I'm hoping that he takes up a big chunk of the story in season 6, because I find his complexity very interesting.
He's a compelling character. I agree with that.
When Bjorn was saying, you'll never be king of Norway, do you want to know why? And he's like, why don't you go ahead and tell me, Bjorn? And he takes a drink, but the look of malice on his face, and also pain, and maybe even just like polite tolerance, I don't know, but there was so much going on there that I was just like, this character is so awesome to watch.
I completely agree. I would like to see more of him. I do find him compelling, like I said already. But you know what else underscores this whole scene and makes you, as the viewer, I think, And it'll be interesting to see in feedback if anybody like disagreed with this and felt like they were like, yay, Bjorn. But you're pulling away from sympathizing with Bjorn because in this exchange, particularly, you feel like you can get behind Harald and his motives because of all the things we talked about, being a self-made man, striving and struggling for stuff that comes hard for him. And Bjorn's acting like the spoiled rich kid at this point and saying like everything's come down through merit of birth mm-hmm. and status. So that's why I'm getting these things, because the gods ordained it. They gave it to Ragnar and they're giving it to Ragnar's sons now. And then I guess he believes that his sons are going to get it too. And so, not that he even knows their names, but maybe his future sons with Gunnhild, right? But so there's that dynamic there where you've got like the person who had to strive for stuff and the person who was just given to.
Right.
And,
okay.
And that I think that's why that you like it's easy to be behind Harald, but all the stuff you brought up too, he is a complex, interesting character mm-hmm. that you want to see have more screen time and go forward. I mean, if the spinoff was about him, the proposed spinoff, I'd be stoked about that.
I was actually startled by the fact that we were seeing a wedding between Bjorn and Gunnhild, and my dad was even in disbelief. And at some point, I was like, "Nope, this is what's happening. They're getting married." And he was like, "No, no." And I'm like, "Yeah, it is. That is what's happening."
Well, he had thought that it was like a dream sequence.
Well, it is filmed like a dream sequence.
Yeah. But he thought like, and I think what might have like cinched it for him was that like once he started to see Harald's reaction, then he was like, see, this is all a dream. But then it was a dream, but it wasn't, kind of, you know.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of psych out going on with the way they filmed that scene.
But still, it was startling. I was not expecting a wedding between them so soon, or at all, really.
Yeah, because, I mean, he had mentioned it in the previous episode. He said that Bjorn had said that she was his intended wife. He said that to Harald. And then they had their talk. And then later on, you get a scene with her and Harald. And then you get a scene with her and Bjorn. Now, of course, the one with her and Bjorn ends up in lovemaking at the end of it. So, but yeah, wedding so fast. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems like that could have ended out this part of the season, or this season, rather than...
I guess I got the impression from last episode that, you know, who she was going to choose really depended on some events that were going to take place in the future. So I wasn't expecting things to culminate so quickly as far as the romance aspect of it.
I could see that. I could totally see that. But yeah, she's hedging her bets, and she's kind of like, okay, well, which one of these guys is going to pull out the big guns and make stuff happen
right
here? You know, but I kind of fear for her now because, I mean, you know, Torvi's the only other wife that's alive, you know, that we know of that Bjorn's had, so... I mean, who knows where Thorin is, if she's still alive. And then Snæfrid from last part of season is, no one even mentions her anymore. So,
yep.
But I think
a good track record.
She's made of tougher stuff, though. She'll be all right, hopefully.
All right, next location. We are now heading to Norway for the first time.
Yeah.
And Fitzurk is arriving to Olaf the Stout's hall after traveling up north through icy mountains and frozen lakes. He arrives with icicles in his eyebrows and his wispy mustache. And due to this discomfort from all this frigid travel, he wants to warm up, and he's insistent on that happening pretty quickly. And he comes off as rude, and he has to apologize, so to speak. I mean, he admits that, yes, I was rude, but he would like to please speak to Olaf the Stout. And Canute says, okay, but I need you to take off your clothes. And so Fitzurk has to strip down to nothing and walk through the snowy streets to a sweat lodge where he finally meets Olaf the Stout, who is a very rotund man.
I was thinking, you know, when he was getting like walked through there, I was like, is you know, is Tyrion going to try some shenanigans on him at this point? Is this where this is going? But no, he just kind of pushes him on the butt and makes him go into the sweat lodge.
The owl made me think of Lagertha, because Lagertha used to walk around with an owl.
The owls are so cute.
They are cute. They always remind me of our cat, Jenkins.
Yeah, they do. They do. A lot of animals remind us of him, but
yeah,
owls especially, which is weird because he's a cat, obviously. So there's that.
They always have that same baleful stare. And like I said, Olaf the Stout's a very rotund guy. And to Fitzurk, he is reminiscent of the Buddha, which he states to Olaf. And he laughs maniacally, just like the man he met in the marketplace of Kattegat, who first introduced Fitzurk to Buddha. And when he asked, who or what is the Buddha, he laughs maniacally.
I love this because you say, he's like, what do you he asks Fitzurk, what does he think of everything here? He's like, truthfully, I think this is all an illusion, and you are like what they call the Buddha. Mm-hmm. And that's when he starts to laugh. And I thought that was a great contrast to the time that he had given Ivar a little bit of his newfound Buddhist wisdom when he was like, well, everything is one and whatever it was that he said. And Ivar's like, what? What are you talking about, this rubbish? So it was kind of I think that was a signal that this person could possibly be sympathetic. And Hurst knew he was pulling you in that direction. So when there's this pullback a little bit later, it hits you that much more.
Yeah. Another thing I like about Fitzurk and his Buddhism, and he's on this journey that we're witnessing, and he's this young person who's searching. And then you have the contrast. I know we're always bringing up contrasts.
Yeah, but it's there.
I think it is there, and it is meant to be noticed. And you've got the contrast of people like Lagertha, Judith, and Floki, who are arriving to their destinations. And I really like that. I like the difference in the sort of resignation. And
there's a generational thing going on.
Yeah, there's that too. But there's just some sort of just different. There's more of a gravitas, I guess, maybe. Hmm. Deservedly so to the elder
right
folks of the show.
Yeah, because their trains are kind of pulling into station. Whereas somebody's like Fitzurk is really just getting out of the gate at this point. He's starting off on his journey, because I would imagine he's probably not even as old right now as Ragnar was when we first took up our acquaintance with him. So was it just me, or did Olaf the Stout strike you in this situation as Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now a little bit?
I didn't. No, I didn't think of that, but I think that's a good comparison.
When he's asking him, he's like, oh, so I've got another Ragnar son. You know, that's respect. And it was kind of funny, because it made me think of, like, are you an assassin or an errand boy?
Yeah, see, I think that's a good call. A good comparison.
On that, to lead from that, like, you know, when he, this is another mention of Ragnar, like I was talking about before. And, you know, like I said, Ragnar's just all over this episode. And so this is a sign of respect that, you know, this wasn't just one of Ivar's trusted henchmen. He actually sent a brother who was, you know, of course, you know, the Stout doesn't know the nature of the relationship between the two. This was more to get him out of Ivar's hair. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was also another bad step in leadership in a lot of bad missteps that Ivar has made, as we shall soon see. So he asks him, what kind of ruler is your brother? He's trying to pick his brain and get to know, is he cruel? Is he a monster? Is this somebody, which is cool. I like that. He's trying to get a feel for him. And he says, well, actually, he's no longer the brother that I once knew. He thinks he's a god. He's turned into a tyrant. And so, you know, Olaf has the obvious reaction I think a lot of people would have, and he's like, well, then why would you come here and tell me this if we were expected to go raid with him? He's like, well, no, that's not what I want you to do. I want you to go back to Kattegat with your army and overthrow this guy. And so Olaf says, actually, I think I'm going to stick to my original plan. I'll see you.
Yeah.
And he gets taken to the sweat lodge, and he's hung up in a pretty uncomfortable position.
Mm-hmm. And he's there for some time, suffering, until Canute comes back in to ask him if he's changed his mind, and he hasn't. He is decided against Ivar, and there's no changing that. And he's released from his restraints painfully, but it just seems like that's what they wanted to make sure of. So this seems like that was the test, was they wanted to make sure, or Olaf the Stout wanted to make sure that he could not be swayed from what his principles, what specifically that they needed to know about Fitzurk here. What do you think?
I think you hit the nail on the head. They wanted to make sure that he wasn't a flip-flopper. Mm-hmm. You come in and ostensibly you're an emissary for your brother who's trying to get together this, you know, raiding force to go hit Wessex. And York, apparently, too, to shore up York and then hit Wessex. And, you know, he says, that's not why I'm here. I, you know, my brother's a bastard and I need you to help me attack him and overthrow him. And he's just like, all right, well, I'm going to let you go hang out, pun intended, for a little bit and see if that changes your mind. Because if that did, and he was like, no, we could go back to the way it was. It shows a lack of character. And I think that would tell him all he needed to know. And I think he would probably at that point just send Fitzurk back and then not participate at all. Because he would just be like, this family screwed up. I don't want to have anything to do with them. But he held to the strength of his convictions.
When Olaf the Stout visits Fitzurk at this point, he tells Fitzurk that he has decided to join him against mm-hmm. Ivar. But he says a couple of words, which closed captioning says in his native language. If you notice the way he says it, the earrings he wears, he has this very Indian, godlike appearance. And this didn't occur to me on my own. It's because I read Sarah Power's review of this episode. Apparently what he says there is actually Hindi.
Okay. He says three words in English, though, too.
Yes, so yeah. Which I think are translations
okay,
of that. The, of so it wasn't his native language, as the closed captioning stated. It was, I don't know if this is for a fact, I tried to look it up on the internet. It sounds like it was actually Hindi words that he was saying. So he's found his own belief system that he's interested in, just like Fitzurk has with Buddhism. But
that I like that, because that would mean that he understood what Fitzurk was saying when he said, and you are like the Buddha, and it just made him laugh. Because if you have a belief system that's far to the east, you know, you're going to know about Buddhism, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure it made Fitzurk intriguing.
Yeah.
But the further testing was trying to find something else about Fitzurk.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with that.
And so what were the three words?
Give, sympathize, control. So I'm not sure exactly how that the meaning of those three taken together would differ greatly if you were talking about what you were trying to do with other people or what you were trying to do as a mastery of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like he was doing that in that sense, in the latter, the mastery of yourself. That's how I took it.
Mm-hmm.
So
like the ingredients for success in life?
Possibly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a weird three to boil down to, honestly.
Is it?
None of the three are bad or weird in and of themselves, but taken together as a group, I don't know how much they complement each other. And maybe that's because I just have a shallow grasp on philosophy, very shallow. So that's why I'm saying that. Maybe mm-hmm. it makes perfect sense to somebody who's studied such things or, you know, just knows more than I do. I like all three of those. And the way that he said it with his conviction
mm-hmm.
made it sound awesome, like rad, you know, like, yeah, let's get to it. But,
the word control makes me think of Floki right away because mm-hmm. of what we saw in Iceland.
Yeah.
The sympathize possibly could make me think of Lagertha, Elswith, and Judith and that scene that they have later on. But anyway, we don't need to dive into that. But I'm sure there's much to mine from just those three words if we're looking at some of our seasoned characters from the series.
And yet, I'm also going to like try to keep those in mind as we go forward with everything that's happening with Fitzurk. Specifically, Olaf too,
mm-hmm.
but Fitzurk more. Because,
so do you think he's found a teacher?
Like a teacher, mentor, whatever you want to call him. I think he's found somebody that he can look up to and who might take him under the wing. Because, yeah, I mean, you definitely have that dynamic going on.
And how does this jive with what the seer predicted about Fitzurk, the great sacrifice?
That I don't know. This yeah. There's going to be some. So at the end of this, Olaf has decided to go with Fitzurk's plan. So now you're going to have, I don't know if it's going to happen at the same time, but it probably will. You're going to have two different armies converging on Kattegat, trying to take control of it from the north and coming from the west. So, you know, Bjorn and Harald, if they can keep everything together, because they're like, they seem like oil and water at this point, but they're trying to make that emulsification to mm-hmm. sort of stay on track. They're going to be coming one way, and then these two are going to be coming down together with King Olaf's army. So I don't know what his sacrifice would be. Maybe he has to sacrifice himself somehow to make sure that Ivar doesn't. That's why he was just linked with Ivar. Maybe his sacrifice is to make sure that Ivar eventually gets taken out. And that's how he pays back, karmically speaking, for sticking around with him and just kind of like not doing anything while he did all this crazy shit. I'm probably way off base on all that.
It's hard to say.
It is.
All right. Up next, we have Kattegat. And the first image we have as we enter Kattegat is the bisected remains of Ivar's statue as he rolls up in his chariot. It seems to have been cleaved by a flaming sword. Again, I'll bring up Sarah Power's recap from Project Fandom, and she suggested that it could have been a lightning strike, which is horrifying. It's already horrifying that he would kill a bunch of people because somebody would have defaced his statue.
Right.
But if it is actually a lightning strike.
So that means that the gods were doing this. And they were that displeased with him. And then he went and did something even worse than whatever he was doing before in retaliation for that.
It means that they weren't involved at all, the humans, and they're being punished for it. Yes. Yeah.
It seems unlikely that no humans were involved. Like, even if it was like lightning that had done that, I feel like it was probably humans who took the boar's head and stuck it
definitely
with the swords. You know, that doesn't the gods can be tricksters and whatnot, but that seems a little bit like beneath them to be doing stuff like that.
Yeah,
their gestures.
I forgot about the boar's head. Yep, no, that's definitely human involvement. And in fact, when he questions Thora, she doesn't even deny it.
No, she doesn't. And you know, I once again, we fall back on this a lot, or at least I do, but I feel like there's missing scene continuity stuff here, because last episode she gets left and says, "Watch out for my brother." You don't see any members of her family until the very end of this particular scene. You don't even know that they exist until mm-hmm. she talks with Ivar. But apparently she is part of some sort of insurrection or movement that is critical of Ivar. And here again, when he asks her about this, Ragnar's brought up once again. Uh-huh. And he's, you know, she says that, you know, he, in Ragnar's time, everybody was free. We could talk, we could say what we wanted to do, and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that's, you're not doing that. He knew that he was just a man. And unlike some people, cough, cough, who think there's something else.
So here he's being compared to his father and he's coming up short.
Yes. Yeah.
And he feigns understanding while marking her for death, and he sends her out. And she walks herself out of Ivar's hall, and the mark on her face draws soldiers to her like filings to a magnet. She runs into the woods, stumbles into a massacre. Her father is among the victims. She is then doused in flammable liquid. As they set the torches to her, flames crawl up her back, and a kid watches as she burns, and his face is also marked for death.
I noticed one of the soldiers, too, is holding like a... somebody who wasn't, they were young. I guess they were a kid too. It was a girl, and he was holding her face like to where she had to watch what was going on. And she had the mark too. Like she would be killed eventually. And it's like, man, just you're adding on this unnecessary wanton cruelty on top of it. Because it's just like you, when you make somebody watch something, generally you let them live as a saying, like, if you keep doing what you're doing, this is going to happen to you. But if you're going to kill them anyway, why would you do that? That's just like super harsh. And this is another reason why I think that we're going to see the demise of Ivar probably in the next couple of episodes. I'm calling it. I'm thinking that like at the end of season 5, you know, in the next 2 weeks, I think we're going to see the death of Ivar because,
wow.
And the reason why I'm saying that is because of everything that happened now, like the, you know, he doesn't have a kid anymore unless something happens at the beginning of next episode.
Mm-hmm.
There's two armies that are going to be converging trying to take him out. You know, he is not that great of a warrior. I don't believe he has the backing of the gods, if they even exist. So I just don't, and all of the stuff that, like, this show has always shown us, when people extend themselves too far on the side of being nasty, they usually get their comeuppance.
I think you're right. I think you're right. With that last point you just made makes sense. And then also talking about not being on the side of the gods, because Bjorn basically said as much to Harald.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean Bjorn's correct about Harald.
True.
But he is correct about the favor of the gods.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
In general.
Everything's pointing in the direction of him not being long for this world.
Mm-hmm.
So, because at some point, what's his path to survival? And some sort of success? I just don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean anything, but that's what my gut's telling me. So, Freydis has the baby, Baldur, and the midwives are
immediately, they're nervous around Ivar. From what they see, and they say that he, Baldur the baby, will not be able to take milk from Freydis' breast. And Freydis is undeterred by this, and she commands for them to give her baby, and she looks at him, and she declares him blessed, while once Ivar gets a hold of him and takes a look at him, he looks at him horrified. And while he's looking at Baldur, she's saying deformity is a true sign of the god's favor.
Right.
Despite her statement, he takes baby Baldur out into the cold wilderness to abandon him. But before he does, he is saying to the baby, "You are not divine because you remind me of myself. I can't allow you to suffer like I have suffered throughout my life." What kind of father would do that to their son, any son. So that specific last line there was really interesting to me because he's declaring Ragnar a terrible father. He's just was compared to Ragnar and he fell short. So this is where he's trying to change the balance here.
Right, right. So he can score a few points and bring it back. But I mean, I guess you can look at it from that way if you believe that with the Viking tradition of doing this, that it's the right thing to do. So he feels like he's actually fulfilling a fatherly duty by doing that. And, you know, as brutal as it is, I guess I see where that's coming from. And from his point of view, he's probably doing this in earnest, is what I'm saying. He's not trying to be cruel. He's not trying to get out of some sort of responsibility because he was all psyched about having a boy and seeing him be able to walk and all of that other stuff. And it doesn't provide an excuse to leave a baby in the wilderness. But I mean, this is it's different times. We can't judge them by our standards kind of thing in certain senses, at least. And so,
I mean, if he wasn't somebody who felt sorry for himself all the time, he could actually provide a loving environment and counteract some of the negativity that would be coming in that kid's path.
Yeah. I mean, he of all people would understand. They would have a bond.
Right.
And, you know, that's obviously not a child of his lineage. We know that. But he wouldn't know that. And he would have that. I don't know. So that kind of strikes me as a little bit odd, too, that I mean, I don't know any stats on the deformity birth rate at that time in that area of the world. But it seems like the fact that this baby is not Ivar's and it's still deformed in one way or another.
Well, I think that it's more of this embarrassment thing for him, too. To have a deformed baby because it has a lot to do with how people view him, whether he's a strong leader or not. And if he's got an heir that is deformed like him, it's proving his cynicism about his faith in his gods. He doesn't really have faith in the gods. He pretends to.
Okay. All right. I see it. I see what you're saying. And it's selfish, too. It uncovers him as being selfish because it's...
we knew that.
But I'm saying, like, he can put like all of, because I was saying I feel like he's earnestly doing that, but then it kind of makes me think, well, maybe he's not earnestly doing this. Maybe this is just something that he's doing to save himself some grief, because like you said, everybody's going to say, well, you know, this kid is deformed and whatever else, and it's always going to remind him of his shortcomings. So it was ultimately a selfish thing rather than it's still fucked up. It's still hard to watch too. And you know, also like we talked about, you brought this up. I hadn't even thought about it, but it's like, if he's slithering away, how did he bring Balder out there in the first place?
He had to stuff Balder in his shirt. That's all I could think of. And it's like, you had that baby that close to you. You're carrying it like a kangaroo, you know? How can you part with the baby?
I mean, that feeling is supposed to like kick in. Like mothers already have it, but the father's supposed to have that feeling once they hold the baby.
Yeah.
The biology of that, from my understanding, I'm not a father, but like it's supposed to kick in and that protectiveness is supposed to come into play. And it just, apparently it just didn't. But are we surprised? It's Ivar.
But he does say, I can't help you anymore. You'll have to make your own way in life. And I think that's a great line, just based on everything we've already seen this episode with Lagertha and Floki specifically.
Yeah.
And now we are finally to Wessex. And we are first with Judith, who is receiving treatment from the local witch wise woman. She's being treated for what's called a wen.
A wen, huh?
A wen is roughly a cyst on the skin. So that confirms lump in the breast, but she's going to confirm it anyway by stating it as a lump in the breast. It's almost like she's under a spell as this woman speaks about shrinking the wen. Become little as a grain of linseed until at last you are nothing at all. Lagertha breaks this spell, crying out. And I say it's a spell because Judith is in a trance and she's kind of woken up out of it by Lagertha's crying out. And the witch is like, oh, you got to leave. You got to get out of here. And Judith immediately wants to know who it is. And she says, it's a crazy woman. I've been looking after her. And we see that it's Lagertha. And Judith has her brought back to the royal villa, and Lagertha is wrestled into the bed, and she ends up having this fever dream that we get to witness her. I mean, we could call it hallucinations, we can call it premonition, or some sort of, I don't know if premonition is the right word. What is it? I guess some sort of sight that gives you impressions from the past that you weren't even there to witness physically, but now you're getting to see from multiple point of views and participate even.
Either we have to look at it as somehow supernatural on some sort of level, which I don't know where to file that one if we're going that way. So I'll just leave it alone just to say that that's an option, I guess. But yeah, I would consider it, for lack of a better term, to be a hallucination. And she's like, her subconscious mind is taking all of these bits of knowledge that she knows happened by talking to people.
And, that's kind of cool, actually.
And getting the story and then replaying it in her mind. And then instead of doing it like differently, like it would appear in somebody's mind who actually wasn't there, Hearst decided to use the actual footage. That way we could get the actual Ragnar for a little bit in the episode. And I think it that hasn't been overused since he's been gone. So I think it's been tastefully done the way he's been brought back. And I mean, you even had like the intermingling of a scene from the season one, mm-hmm. and then his you know, the final death in the snake pit and stuff like that. And so, yeah, I took there to be, I'm not good at dream analysis, much less hallucination analysis. So I don't know what to like tack things where, but the fact that she was using King Ella's voice, or it came out of her, I wonder if there's guilt involved in this.
I wondered the same.
There's a sort of remorse involved in it. There's
even though she forgave him before he went off.
Right. But I don't know. It's those emotions are just all so sticky. And
yeah, that's true.
And they don't conform to like, you can't put them in a box and then put them on a shelf. They ooze out of things and they get into different places where they're not supposed to be. I know it's making a really nasty sounding analogy here, but
but they can be nasty like that.
Yeah.
No, I like that. And I also like the fact that, you know, it's still up for debate whether this is something that's supernatural, or is it possibly like bits and pieces, like you've said, that she's heard, because she's probably heard things that King Ella probably said at the time of Ragnar's death. So it would make sense that she would inhabit Ella and be making those proclamations or whatever, you know. And so she would be in these multiple perspectives because there was probably multiple stories that she heard.
And, you know, at the end of the line where all of these people in her life have left her or betrayed her, or that she's killed, I feel like this is a purge. I feel like for her character, she's going to move forward without her defenses, but also possibly without her baggage, if that's possible. So this could be like a somewhat of a tabula rasa for her if that's the way that it's going. I have no idea. But that's kind of the, you know, that's what I was getting off of, the vibe.
This scene made what developed with Lagertha better for me, because I was kind of just disappointed with the Lagertha that we saw. Mm-hmm. I was just mostly like, God, really? This is just not interesting to me. I just don't want to see her crazy. I want her to die with her boots on. I don't want this. But when it developed into this, I liked it more, and I'm excited to see what a wizened Lagertha is going to discover as she declares it's going to happen for her and Judith. I do wish they did look a little bit older, because it would be more in line with the things that are coming out of their mouths in this episode. But, you know, we end up rewinding this scene with her witnessing what happened to Ragnar multiple times to try to capture everything and just see it. And it was so powerful. I kind of almost felt the loss of it when we finally quit rewinding it and moved on to the next scene.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. What did you make of at the beginning of the scene when she's running and then there's two of her?
I know that was...
One of them's running away and one of them's running towards the action, which is Ragnar's death. I felt like there was two parts of her, and one was forging forward with wherever that's going to take her, and the other one had to stop and do this one last thing, or maybe died there with him. That part of her died there with him, and she can move on now.
That makes sense, because, you know, the part of her vision was that time they had together, that where she was actually there when he talks about the dream he had of her feeding him blood pudding, and what it meant to him is that she gave him his heart. And that got my mind thinking too. Is that why she's had so many failures in love since then? Because that was the case, that it could never truly be reciprocated back because she wasn't able to give.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she couldn't, like you're saying, she couldn't fully be there 100% for anybody else because the shadow of Ragnar loomed over. They were supposed to be together. He fucked it all up. I was thinking about that the other day, and yeah, you wouldn't have hardly any of the story that we have in Vikings if he didn't go off and do all of the things he did. It was necessary. I get it. But at the same time, that romantic in me is just like, man, you know, it's like that, those things happening in real life when you find that person are so few and far between, and then you go screw it up with Oslog. Come on. So anyway.
Well, I mean, do you think when she says later, because she's having dinner once she's recovered a little bit with Alfred, Judith, and Elswith, how that she's no longer a shield maiden since she no longer has her shield. What is she referring to? It can't be just an actual shield, because you can get another shield.
Right. Yeah, you could go to the armory and get yourself suited up really nice, I'm sure. I took it to be, it's obviously, it's a metaphorical thing, and I think her shield was whatever she left behind with this whole, because I said I felt like it was a purge. So she was getting rid of bad, but she was also getting rid of good. She emerged from this as somebody who is able to forge on in a different direction with a different set of tools in her kit. Don't know what they might be yet, but she's going to have to like find her way in the world without the identity of Lagertha the Shield Maiden, Lagertha the Viking Queen. She's now going to just be this person, mm-hmm. and find out who Lagertha really is. And I think that's the heart.
That's interesting.
That's the heart of what she's telling Judith when she paints her face as a warrior. Mm-hmm. She gives her warrior marks and mm-hmm. says, we're not done fighting yet. We're just not going to do it in the way that we have up until this point been accustomed to. Our journey is going to take us in a different place. Sorry, I'm saying that definitively. That's just my thought. I don't mean it to be that way. But I do agree with you when you were saying, you know, at this point where she, Elswith is freaking out because Judith says that she has a lump in her breast and she's heard of that and she's dying. Mm-hmm. And she gets all crazy because she's just like, well, she probably hangs out with Judith all day while Alfred is off doing kingly things. So they're probably like,
so what do you agree with me?
I agree with you in the fact that when she says, I can't bear it. And Lagertha's like, you're young. You can bear almost anything. And so you were saying that like it would help out a lot if they looked a little bit aged, because they don't look like these women who are a full generation older.
Right. And I had said that when we were watching that mm-hmm. that line would actually feel more realistic if they had actually looked their age.
Right. Give them some wrinkles. And this has been a complaint that, you know, you've had for a while, that our listeners have had for a while, mm-hmm. that it's just like, okay, these people look like they do. You know, you change the hair color a little bit, or you give them different haircuts, but, you know, but some people you try to age up, and then other people you just leave it. And I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, outside of the universe stuff. You still got to have, air quote here, sexy characters to get people to the screen who haven't been there before, I mean, unfortunately.
I also said the first time we watched when Elswith started crying like that, I was like, girl, you just got here. But
you don't know anybody.
I, you know, upon repeat viewing, though, I got the impression, though, just based on the lack of response from Elswith when Judith says that she murdered her son, that she knew that this was not new information to Elswith. So I think Elswith and Judith have developed a very serious and intimate bond, mm-hmm. Over the love that they share for Alfred.
Yep. Like, I imagine her saying that, like, I killed my son to save my son, who is your husband, and your unborn child. You know? Yeah. Then it's like high five and hug time. Thanks, girl. I got your back.
I mean, Lagertha turns her head when she says that she murdered her son, but she's more responding to the lump in her breast.
Yeah, yeah. I think, like, Lagertha's interest in stuff like that, it's like she thinks it's like, that's nothing that I would ever do. She couldn't ever picture herself killing Bjorn, probably under any circumstances, because it would never be necessary, right? But like, I think she realizes these Wessex people are cut from a different cloth, and that's how they roll. You know, there's all that kind of shenanigans, the royal court intrigue.
I don't know. I imagine Lagertha probably would understand it.
Okay.
You don't want to believe that because you have such a strong position against Judith. But I think Lagertha would understand it.
All right. I mean, I would just have to agree to disagree. There's no harm in that.
Before we move on to Uba's story, I just want to say that when Lagertha painted Judith's face with the lapis lazuli, that was what she was using to paint that painting. And Judith is still carrying on the hobby she started, which was due to Athelstan.
Oh, I did not make that connection.
So cool. Athelstan was also in this episode there. And also you can hear Athelstan's voice in the opening of that fever dream as well. So it's not just Ragnar that's in this episode. Ragnar has the strongest presence, but Ragnar is in some ways supported by Athelstan at moments.
Yeah. So that is kind of cool.
As well as Judith.
That he was there for him, even in somebody else's
right.
hallucination. Nothing could come between those guys. All right. So the next scene in Wessex is Ube and Torvi are at the head of the Saxon army, and they're going to meet the three Danish kings who are coming to invade. And there's a quick scene that we have where one of the, I'm guessing this is one of the other commanders, it tries to question Ube on his methods. And he's like, hey, we should attack these guys right now. And he's like, no, this is how we're going to do it. We're going to go talk. And the guy's like, well, blah, 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 blah. You know, he puts him in his place. Ube puts him in his place. And he says, well, if you want to challenge your king against the guy who he put in charge of the army, go ahead. And that zips him real quick. And so when they get to, you know, a bunch of archers come out and are threatening them, and they get put on a boat and they're taken out to, it looks like, a little island somewhere.
Yeah, probably some claimed territory that they're...
Right. Or something that they, you know, there's no, like, presence, you know, no Saxon military presence on, at least. And so as they're getting off the boat, him and, you know, Ube and Torvi are understandably a little bit nervous about this, because they're going to be welcomed as fellow Vikings, but at the same time, like, what are you doing with these other people, you know, with the Saxons? But Uba's, you know, his reception with this army, or these three armies, is actually pretty warm. They start banging their shields with their axes and swords, and they're chanting his name.
Yeah. Immediately I was like, I can't stop this feeling deep inside of me, because it sounded like that.
So that's the
Uba Chaka. Yeah. Uba Chaka Chaka.
So Uba and Torvi are taken to the three kings. And what were their names? Hemming, Frodo, and...
King Angantyr.
Angantyr.
And Angantyr is played by Catherick Winnick's brother.
That's cool.
Mark John Winnick. Mark Jan, Mark John. I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
So, of course, they want to know why Uba is with the Saxons, and he lays it out for them pretty clearly, and he says, look, you know, this was the fruition of my father's plan, and we got the land, so if you guys want to, you know, put down the sword and pick up the plowshare and the loom, you can make a great life for yourself. And it shows that there's a lot of impetus with the other groups of Vikings that this is a thing. You know, they have to raid for money and food, and... where they're living is not so always so conducive to be able to support people like that. So it turns out that two of the kings are down with this. And the third one, however, is not.
That's Frodo.
And that is Frodo. And Ube says, okay, well, I've got a quick and easy solution to this. I challenge you to one-man combat with, I'm assuming, the winner of that becoming the new king, or at least getting the leadership of that group of people for the time being, or being able to make decisions for them. But this guy is pretty fucking big.
He is.
So this is this is going to be a pretty brutal fight next episode, I'm sure.
You think we're going to open with it? Just like season two opened up with that big battle when Rollo and Jarl Borg were on the same team.
Oh, yeah.
And they're eating the berserker mushrooms.
I don't know. I'm like jonesing for this fight, because I feel like, I don't feel like this is where we're getting off the Uba train. So I feel like he's going to win, but he's going to take a lot of punishment for it. And I think there's going to be a rocky moment where he sees Torvi over to the side looking pissed that he's not fighting as well as he could. And then he rallies back.
Oh, wait. Speaking of Torvi, I really loved how she walked into their debate that he was having with the three kings. And she's talking about how it's necessary to negotiate for long-term arrangements. You know, most women know this, but men, nah, they just kind of want to just fight and find that they should have not killed a bunch of people and maybe have negotiated first. And Paige is looking at her and they're like, who is this woman? And I really liked how Uba was like, Shield Maiden, Torvi, my wife. He started with Shield Maiden, then said her name, and then said my wife.
I actually got shit from somebody one time, a friend of ours in Boise, when I did that to you. Because somebody, we were with Doug, and we were out somewhere, and somewhere in the Boise nightlife, I don't remember where, and somebody had asked us, like I had to make an introduction, and I said your name, and then I didn't add that you were my wife.
Right.
You know, I just let this is who this is, because I was the one that knew that other person, and I was making the introductions. And Doug was like, aren't you going to say that that's her wife, your wife? And I'm just like, well, I mean, if he gets to know us, he'll figure that out pretty quick.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, I don't lead with that, though, is the point. And I got, you know, it like, so it's funny that, you know, you watch that and you feel like that was he showed her proper respect by doing it that way. These are the most important things. She's a Shield Maiden first. She's Torvi. You should have heard about her. And I'd also like to add, she's my wife. You know, and that's the way you should do it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's a preference thing. I personally like to think of myself, what sums me up is more than just the fact that I'm your wife. So why would I lead with that? But a lot of women do, because I remember, and I think I've told you this before, where, you know, some classrooms, like some teachers do this annoying thing where they want you to stand up and introduce yourself and say something about yourself.
Right.
And I noticed that a lot of women will stand up and the first thing they'll say is, I'm married, and then everything else after. And I refuse to ever do that. I didn't even say I'm married.
I can totally picture that. And I think it's an understanding of personalities. And, you know, it's one of the things where personalities mesh, because I think, like, if I was the type of guy who was uncomfortable with you being that way, we never would have got married in the first place, because there would have been a bunch of other things that we didn't see eye to eye on. And so it should never be a slight towards the other person, because that other person that you're with should feel the same way, because
we are together.
Yeah. I don't feel defined by, you know, that's not the first thing I tell people. You know, I don't walk around being like, hi, my name's Steve and I'm married. You know, it either comes up in a conversation or it doesn't. But anyway, we're going way down the road.
Well, at least we've covered the episode before we started doing that.
Yeah, we did. So I feel like at this point, Vikings is on a tear. I feel like
I agree. This is actually turning out to be a good season.
The episode 5 of season 5B started off, the big battle is where it got really good. I never thought it was bad this season, but it started off in a fashion that felt like it could have led to a little bit more mediocrity than we would be comfortable with, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't think we were alone in feeling that. But once we got to episode 5, it just kicked it up a notch and it stayed there. So I'm really happy with the show right now.
Me too. All right, we're going to head right into feedback. So up first, we've got a little note regarding the previous episode, episode 17. They were commenting on the title, which the title was The Most Terrible Thing. And this is from Peggy. And Peggy says, maybe it's called The Most Terrible Thing because several of what humanity has considered as the absolute worst sins occur. Suicide, filicide, possible cannibalism. Avon says, we are all meat.
Hmm.
So, first of all, I think you might be confirming it was cannibalism by linking Avon's statement by saying we are all meat with the possible cannibalism for him to actually view them as that.
Yeah.
After seeing somebody he loves treated so much as that.
Literally.
Makes sense. I wanted to bring up this episode, the Balder episode, what Avon had said last episode about we being all meat, because we have something similar echoed by Kietel when he says, you have sex with a woman, you have a child. Who in the hell knows about that child? Like this distance from those sort of connections. It's a loss of humanity.
Yeah, it is, because you're just viewing everything as this animal function.
I also think Peggy's answering our question about what you would call killing your own child, and that would be filicide.
Filicide, okay.
Thank you, Peggy.
Thank you.
All right, up next we have Timothy writing in for the first time, and Timothy says, hello. I just found the podcast a couple weeks ago, and I've loved hearing the discussions about the show. I usually don't get a chance to watch in time to write in, so I'm excited to finally be able to. This episode was one of those that managed to be really enjoyable without any action of any kind. I really enjoyed seeing both Bjorn and Ubba channel some of their father in their own ways. Ubba understands the importance of compromise, while Bjorn sees the value in making alliances with your enemies. Even the Iceland story was better. I particularly enjoyed seeing Floki showing a bit of his old crazy self when he threatened Kjetil. But the best parts of this episode were Lagertha and Judith. They both got back a little to the characters we loved long ago. Even though Lagertha is broken, she seems stronger and more independent than she's been ever since she fell under the Whisper Talk spell. I guess he was not a fan of Hegmund. And Judith has felt more like a conniving, power-mad monarch for at least the last half season. But this felt more like the Judith that was smart and resourceful and trying to do the best she could while maintaining her sense of self. I am really excited to see what can happen if the two of them team up. And of course, it was nice to see Travis again, if only in flashback. This seemed very fitting in an episode where a lot of characters seem to be going back to more of their true selves. Predictions. I didn't watch the preview for next week. 1. Ivar's baby is saved by someone, and when there is the inevitable jump in time, next season Baldur is grown and will be the one to ultimately be Ivar's downfall. 2. Baldur was born with no eyes. This could be a sign about Ivar's guilt for the seer's death, but it wouldn't explain why he wouldn't be able to nurse. Well, that was one thing I didn't mention in our coverage. I believe it's likely cleft palate. So I work in the dental field, so I know quite a bit about that, and that's what it sounds like to me. So that's my...
You pretty much said that right away, I think.
Yeah.
When they said that the baby wouldn't be able to take milk.
Right. Timothy says, 3, Floki goes into the cave and has to face all of the ghosts of the death he feels responsible for, and that would be a long list. Eyjud, Helga, Angerboda, Tanaruz, Athelstan, and of course Ragnar. 4, Magnus dies. Maybe I'm just hoping this one happens. Anyway, thanks for the great show. And he signs off Tim. Thanks, Tim. Good feedback. Good first-time feedback.
Yeah, thank you for writing in. You know, 4, Magnus dies. Maybe I'm just hoping this one happens. We're all hoping that one happens, but I don't think it's going to happen.
It should be 1.
Number 1 on the wish list.
Yeah.
I like what you're saying about Judith and Lagertha both getting back to the characters that we loved long ago. Even despite their particular handicaps physically and mentally.
I just want you to know I haven't stopped loving Judith.
Wait, it's a divided house. You know, I'm not a Judith hater. I just stand behind the assessment that I made at the time about what was going on with, you know, there's a difference. I can still come back around to seeing her as the good character that she is, and good in the sense of compelling to watch. But
when I'm watching it with you and my dad, it's 2-1.
Hey, I mean, you've got,
you guys are a couple of Judith haters.
You've got 90% of the listenership, at least 90% of the people who write in to us are on your side. So me and your dad can, you know, like, high five on the couch about this one. You know, just that it's 1 hour a week. Anyway, thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Tim.
All right. Up next is Raven. She says, "Hey, Em and Steve, this episode had me hopeful for things to come in the last 2 episodes, and here are thoughts for the episode. Karma. Judith and Ivar finally are experiencing the consequences of their actions. Judith with breast cancer and Ivar having his statue destroyed and his, quote, son born deformed. However, I think this might be just the beginning of the consequences to come. Usually when dictators are losing power, their statues are destroyed. Saddam Hussein, for example. So maybe the destroyed statue is a symbol for Ivar losing power. The thinking of karma is very Buddhist, which is something that Bitzerk is both experiencing and exploring. By the way, Ivar, not cool burning your brother's girl. That might have its own consequences down the way."
Oh yeah, better.
Yeah, it's like we talked about, or at least it's my opinion, that there's a stacking up of all of the stuff in the bad column, and the bad guys don't ultimately survive in this show. Raven goes on to say, "Women of power. I see a parallel story again with Judith and Lagertha versus Ekbert and Ragnar, with parallel scenes where Ekbert and Ragnar were getting drunk in the main hall and pondering over their life experiences."
Ah, I like that.
"Judith and Lagertha are in the art studio and trying to figure out what the next chapter of their life will be. With the men, they were looking back, and with the women, they were looking forward in life to see where they take it." I like that.
That's a great, great pull.
Yeah, that is good. Raven goes on to say, Random, what is it with Floki, Insight, and caves? Why is Bjorn now getting a clue? Will Finehair die at season's end?
Nope.
We're hoping not. How will Ivar get kicked out of Kattegat? Will Ube survive? These are just some rambling questions from a raven on top of a burnt and destroyed statue of Ivar. Raven. Oh, man.
Fist pumping in the air, right? Yeah. On top of that statue.
Cawing as loud as possible. I think, okay, will Finehair die at season's end?
No.
No. Well, how will Ivar get kicked out of Kattegat? My vote is he's getting killed. Don't know how much traction I'm going to get with this or how realistic it is, but that's what I'm feeling.
He will function as his new effigy.
Will Ube survive? Yes, I think so. I think he will.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think Ivar will be burned alive, actually. I think I'm going to call that one now.
Hmm.
That's what's going to happen there. And I think Raven has introduced me to the idea that it's going to be Fitzurk who gives him this dose of his own medicine. Thank you, Raven. That's my new theory. Yes. That's what I'm going with. It's like we're playing Clue. I'm going with Fitzurk and Ivar with the fire in the Great Hall.
Hmm. Would his belief system allow him to do that?
Just this once, yeah. it's not like he's committed to it. He's not in a monastery. He's just exploring. You know?
You're right.
So it's. Thank you, Raven.
Thank you.
All right. Up next is Sarah, a.k.a. Donuts, a.k.a. Dr. D's. She says, hey, guys, wow, that episode was really something, right? So many storylines. So listen, Catherine Winnick is a goddess and can do no wrong. But aren't we all a little bit sick of this narrative on TV and in society where women are beautiful and strong until one day they're suddenly old and crazy? I know they don't mean any harm by it, and Hurst is probably chuckling in Brilliant Englishman about how genius this is. But it is more than a little ironic that half their audience is sitting here hating how society thinks we expire at 40, and Lagertha, the woman we all wish we could be, up and falls apart. I saw people on Twitter thanking Vikings for letting her finally be human, but that's exactly the point. Human women do not age like that. As a woman keeping so many balls in the air for my own family, I have certainly wondered, when do I get to lose my shit and let the rest of the world pick up the pieces? Let me tell you, the answer is never. That's not to say she didn't do a great job going crazy and hallucinating Ragnar's death, because of course she did. When she painted Judith's face with blue, that breath between them felt holy, and I was so moved. That moment is one of two where three women are together. In this case, you could see it as a transition from the maiden Elswith to mother and mothers, Judith and Lagertha, to crones. The other instance is when Judith finds Lagertha in the witch's hut, which reminds me of the three Norns, or Fates, who lived at the base of Yggdrasil. Each of these women have had the cords of lives in their hands, and each, probably including the witch, have cut those cords. They are also believed to draw near to the birth of babies, which fits with Baldur's birth and the impending birth of Alfred's heir. One cord was cut, while the other will perhaps be luckier. There were some great moments in this episode. Floki's last reminder of who he used to be. The first meeting of the Ube fan club. Olaf's owl being offended by Fitzurk. Toxic Harold's return. And some not great moments. Thora getting fridged, while Fitz doesn't mention her one time. Ivar stranding Baldur. Kettle being horrible about his daughter. It's a mixed bag. Hope everyone had a great weekend. The Donuts.
Hear, hear for the Toxic Harold's return.
Toxic, yes. We second that. I think that was in the, so that was part of the great moments. Cool. All right. I was making sure that she hadn't put that in Toxic Harold's return in the bad moments. So, do you want to extrapolate on any of the thoughts about, women at 40 or over 40 and the betrayal?
Well, I've already said, my thoughts about that. I just, especially some of the lines that they're given, they just seem silly when they look younger.
Right.
Than they're supposed to be saying those lines. especially when they said that one specific one to Elswith.
You can bear anything because you're so young.
Right. Yeah.
And we're just so old. Look at these wrinkles on our beautiful, beautiful faces.
I know.
We don't look a day over 20, but, one of them's a grandmother and the other one's about to be. And I know, you know, that stuff happened earlier back in those days, but that's not an excuse. So.
And, but I really loved how you were moved by that scene between Lagertha and Judith and how you described the breath between them feeling holy. I thought that was really nice way to describe it. It's even beautiful to sound cheesy, but.
No, I agree. I agree. It almost gets you choked up when you read it, because like, or when I read it and then you said that and I was like, oh, you get that jolt of emotion because you're, you know, it's just part of it, you know, it gets you there.
And then connecting the women to the Norns or the Fates. I love that. And talking about how they're drawn to babies and you have Balder and the impending birth of Alfred's heir. That's so cool. And only Donuts has that perspective that she can bring.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for doing that, because it makes this conversation so much cooler.
Yeah, I mean, we lucked out because out of all the Vikings podcasts out there, you're writing into ours. Unless you're writing into a bunch of others, too, which in case that's just not cool.
I don't know if there's any active ones. Really? I think we're the only active one.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's why. We're just the only game in town now. Yeah. So she has to tangle with us. Anyway, thank you very much.
Yes,
we appreciate
it. Thank you, Sarah.
All right. Up next, and our final piece of feedback for the night, is the undefeated Sam Spade. And Sam says, King Harold is forever scheming and creeping around when it comes to women. It's a big blemish on an otherwise true Viking that I like. Too bad he's such a creep, though.
I like him. I mean, I wouldn't hook up with him, but...
You know, it occurred to me that Harold would possibly be happier, like, if he would not necessarily lower his standards, but, like, try to find love with like organically occurring relationships where you actually find that love.
Quit trying to force it.
Yeah. I mean, you pick these women who are unattainable, mm-hmm. and then you bash your head up against the wall because you can't do it. And then, like Sam says, you end up being creepy because instead of being happy for people who just got married, you're grinding your teeth down to nothing watching these people going, like imagining yourself having sex with the bride. So. Sam goes on to say, Olaf the Hutt. That's what I'm calling this guy. He's like, you look like the Buddha. Fitzirk. All right. Much respect to Fitzirk for not protecting Ivar and attempting to seize an opportunity, but I have to deduct some points for leaving pretty contrived plot device, a.k.a. Thora, behind to be horribly killed by Ivar, as I'm sure many of us expected.
Yep.
Fuck that guy. But also... Here's another character introduced and then just tossed away. Yeah, unfortunately, she can't. I mean, think about it. We didn't even know her name until last episode. Mm-hmm. We knew it before that because you would, you know, pause it and you could see it. But it was never spoken aloud till last episode. Now she's dead. Sam goes on to say, Floki, though, man waits until it doesn't even matter to grow a pair and then let someone know there was a time in which he really wasn't the one to fuck with. But. I mean, goddamn, Floki. When talking shit, you want to let the other guy know you are about that thug life. I get that. But was the line about the sun necessary? I can only think that the Floki that Floki is referring to is pre-season one Floki.
Yeah. So like I said, I don't remember ever meeting that Floki.
I think we both agree that this is probably like, I kind of attributed it to just bravado, to just kind of pump up that shit talking, to really drive it home that he would have done some gnarly shit. So hopefully it's just an exaggeration, something that he pulled too far. Sam goes on to say, I love Lagertha. I will always love some Lagertha. I just find it odd how this developed Lagertha leaving the field of battle and going off on her own is fine. Okay, going Margrethi is... I question that, but okay. Ending up in the same witch's hovel Judith goes to? I'll go with it a bit. Snapping out of Margreth mode with a vision about Ragnar's final moments? Fuck it. I love that. That segment always sends something through me. And to revisit the end of this character? Tears, man. Yeah, I think we were all there with you. It was a tearjerker. When he was talking about soon he's going to be drinking ale from curved horns and no apologies for his death while his face is bloody. Sam says, the icing on the cake for me is seeing two strong women, two brave warriors in their own methods, face to face. It's the joining of two of the wisest characters on this show. It's a shame that I don't feel we'll get more of them together, though. Fuck Ivar, by the way.
That's all he's got to say about that.
Well, I don't know. I like the idea that Raven put forward that she thinks that she's going to see, that we're going to see Lagertha and Judith drinking in the hall and, you know, talking about the future, and as a parallel to Ekbert and Ragnar drinking in the same hall and talking about the past. And I hope that's the case. So hopefully it won't be a shame that we don't get to see more time on screen with them, because we will. So, does that mean if you think about it, where the real action is happening right now, we're always going to get it. If we're going by how this season has gone so far, we're always going to get a certain portion of the episode in Wessex. And now with Iceland being slimmed down to pretty much just Floki, that's probably not going to take up as much. So whatever's happening in Wessex is going to revolve around Lagertha and Judith and Alfred to a certain extent, because you've got Ube and Torvi doing mm-hmm. their thing, and then you've got the other stuff across the, mm-hmm. the water. So I hope that gives us in the, you know, the last hour and a half that we have until November that we get some of those scenes, hopefully. Anyway, thank you for your feedback. Awesome as usual.
But with Lagertha's current state, I'm starting to lean more toward the idea that Gunhild is going to be that warrior that dies in England, and her remains are going to be what's found in present day time.
I can go with that.
It won't be Lagertha.
I can go with that. Because if we're following the seer's prophecies, Lagertha has to die somewhere where there was, what, marble columns or something like
yeah.
that?
Yeah. So now I'm wondering if it's, we were all thinking it was going to be Italy because of that, but I'm wondering if it's going to be like maybe a mausoleum?
Hmm. Yeah. Because, I mean, in 5A... It was 5A, right, where Bjorn and Halfdan had went to the Mediterranean.
Yeah, but so, I mean, I think he's still going to end up back there. I don't know.
So much speculation. That's half the fun of this show, mm-hmm. is speculating what's going to happen, because you have these very, very vague and not necessarily to be adhered to real world historical guidelines, and then you have what Hearst wants to do. Sometimes they match up very neatly, and sometimes they're in two different color and books altogether. All right, so that covers it for our coverage and your feedback. Thank you, guys. You guys are all awesome, and we really appreciate it. We'll see you same time next week. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
And I am your host, Em.
Axe time.
Sword time.
Shields are splintered.
Till we raid again.
Till we raid again.